couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. First of all, we're going to be talking about Dumb and Dumber 2. We're also going to be talking about Beyond the Lights, Besides Still Waters, and Wolves. Not sure why that didn't come out in October, but there you go. There'll also be news, some listener feedback, the trailer park, the box office predictions, and of course the world famous DVD roundup. But before we get started with that, this is how you can get a hold of me. If you want to email me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com and on facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. If you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr. Follow me for a good time.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. Let's roll right into the news. There's some frustrating superhero news happening this week. The first one deals with Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, which I originally thought was going to be a great idea. But there are just things happening that, it's getting very crowded. It's going to be overly dark. But now they've come out and we found out that there's going to be an origin story for Batman. Like, we need another freaking origin story for Batman. Is there anybody out there who does not know that Bruce Wayne's parents were murdered and that's what made him become Batman? We've seen this before, and also we saw this 9 years ago. When Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice comes out, it will be just about 10 years after the Batman Begins movie, which told about how his parents died in that movie, and it's only 10 years ago, and it was only in 2012 that we got the last Batman movie. And on top of it, back in 1989, we saw the Batman origin story done with Michael Keaton as Batman. We know the story. Why do we need to have another origin story? I understand, you know, if you're taking some of these more obscure characters, even when they brought in Iron Man, that makes sense to give him an origin story, because not everybody knew who Iron Man was before 2008. But everybody knows who Batman is, and everybody knows he's an orphan, and everybody knows he's a billionaire. This is nothing new. We are getting another origin story in a superhero, but they're, of course, changing it, which is, this one kind of makes me laugh. Apparently, the guy who's going to be playing Dr. Doom in the new Fantastic Four movie had an interview, and he was talking about the origins of the character. And his character, Dr. Doom, isn't this tragic story about a privileged man from this fake European country who had been disfigured. No, he's a blogger. This is such a terrible idea. And this reminds me of when they were talking about rebooting Murder, She Wrote with Octavia Spencer, and she was going to be a blogger. And of course, that never got off the ground. But apparently, that's what this thing is in Doctor Doom in the new Fantastic Four movie. I bet you guys are thinking, all you fanboys out there who dumped all over Tim Story's movies, which I actually kind of liked, he's probably not looking so bad right now. Because even though he changed Dr. Doom's storyline, he wasn't a blogger. Just it's so this making a character a blogger in a movie is like the equivalent of a music teacher in the late 80s saying to the class, "Hey guys, we're going to be cool, so we're going to learn a rap." And they would then proceed to not at all understand how rapping actually works. In even more bizarre superhero news, the Amazing Spider-Man series, apparently, they're toying around the idea of a spinoff movie with Aunt May, who, if you recall, was played by Sally Field in this new series. But in the old series, the Sam Raimi series, I don't know who she was, but she was like 190 years old. They're going to tell the story of when she was younger and was a spy. This just reeks of desperation from Sony Pictures, because Sony only has the rights to the Spider-Man franchise. They don't have the rights to the Avengers. They don't have the rights to the Hulk. They don't have the rights to the Fantastic Four. They just have Spider-Man. And they are stubbornly wanting to develop their own cinematic universe, but they don't have multiple characters. And that's what even the X-Men, Fox can deal with the Fantastic Four, and the X-Men and Marvel, which is owned by Disney, can deal with everybody else. Spider-Man, that's just all they have. They just have Spider-Man. And it's just, this is sad. This reeks of desperation. There was a bit of news this week that got a lot of people excited. Margot Robbie, who of course everybody knows is the blonde bombshell from The Wolf of Wall Street last year. Apparently she's been cast as Harley Quinn in the Suicide Squad movie, which is, of course, a DC film. And that's got a lot of people excited. And then everyone put the brakes on because we find out that Jai Courtney is probably going to be Deadshot. I wish they would just wait until the new Terminator movie comes out just to be sure that he's not just a total franchise killer, because Jai Courtney's boring and nobody cares about him. I don't know why he gets roles. He's got a fantastic agent. He's basically a new version of Sam Worthington, and Sam Worthington at least had Avatar under his belt and then had the 1-2 punch of Clash of the Titans, which did well. Both of those did well, have nothing to do with Sam Worthington. And that guy just kind of lived off of that for a while, and now nobody cares. What did Jai Courtney ever do to make him a big deal? I don't know. He's got pictures of somebody. The final piece of news I want to talk about, I had seen this floating around, and there, a listener, Tim from Ohio, brought this up to me on Twitter. I'm just going to read his Twitter string to you. He says, here's a news story for you. Wow, some woman sprayed a guy in the face with mace after asking her to turn off her cell phone during a movie. People suck, and theaters need to install cell phone jammers. He actually originally wrote hammers. It was in Twitter. He sent me a direct message. He wrote hammers. And I actually kind of like the idea of having cell phone hammers instead. Giant cartoon hammers that you can bash somebody's cell phone if they use it during a movie. I think that'd be better than cell phone jammers. No, what really happened was this woman was in the Chinese theater in Los Angeles, and this guy asked her to turn off her cell phone, and apparently he tapped her on the shoulder, and she took that as an assault, and she pulled out mace and sprayed him, and then sat there and watched the movie for like 20 minutes before security got her. There's no excuse for, I mean, unless somebody's really honest to God assaulting you, you shouldn't be spraying any sort of like pepper spray or mace in a enclosed space like that anyways, because it's going to hit a lot of people. It's going to do damage outside. But the bottom line is, how bad has it gotten that people then assault somebody because they're asking, hey, can you put that giant glowy object away? It's gotten that bad. And I actually ran into something like that. I was at a movie screening, and there's a woman in the front, down front. She's checking text. I don't know what it is. Usually what I do, since I go to so many press screenings, I just go get the security and say, hey, look, that guy's taping the movie. That guy's pirating the film. And they usually get that person out pretty quickly. I just lie. This woman, I said, can you turn it off? And she's like, you better back up. And she's like yelling at me. And I'm like, oh. So I went and I got the rep who I knew. And I said, this woman just like went crazy. Kick her out. And so the rep did. But I don't know. I mean, people are just on the unwashed masses going to movies. This is terrible. And if it's going to get so bad that people are going to not only obnoxiously use their cell phone, but then get obnoxious and violent if somebody tells them to please stop, yeah, people just need to be checked. But they're never going to install jammers. They're never going to install anything. Theater owners are terrified that people are going to stop going to the movies because, you know, 20 years ago, the best theatrical experience you could have at home was on 30, 40 inches, if that. Tube TV was what, 35? 36 inches or something like that. And it was a tube TV. But now with flat screens, you can, for a good pretty penny, you can get a 70-inch television and put a 5.1 or 7.1 surround sound system in your room. You can have a theatrical experience in your basement and top what you get in the movie theaters. And that's why the theater owners don't want to tell anybody they can't do anything, because they're afraid they're going to lose patrons. All right, you're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means we're rolling into the trailer park. First one I want to play is Insurgent. This opens on March 20th. It's the sequel to Divergent.
Chris, help me! Move!
Yeah, not a lot going on in that trailer. Just a lot of yelling. It looks like it's kind of that dream experience. It looks like an interesting trailer. I don't know if it's going to be any good as a movie, because I thought the first one was terrible. But I mean, the trailer's kind of cool. I just hope the rest of the movie's like that. The next one I want to hit is one that dropped a couple weeks ago, but I haven't talked about it yet, is Furious 7.
Dominic Toretto, you don't know me. You're about to...
Looks like the sins of London have followed us home.
Remember Owen Shaw? This is his big bad brother.
We're being hunted.
One last ride.
I think what's fascinating about these movies is how far they've come from just being a street racing movie. I mean, they used to be like stealing TVs. And now they're like blowing things up. I mean, this is a spy movie at this point. This is basically just a James Bond movie with different characters. It's ridiculous. They're fun, but they've gotten so far off track of what the original first two or three movies are. It's just crazy. They're fun to watch, but I mean, the series is just kind of, it's gone like a rocket, like one of those fireworks that just spins off into space. Need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Dumb and Dumber 2 and Wolves. Welcome back to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. I'm going to be talking about Dumb and Dumber 2 first. Reunited after 20 years, Harry and Lloyd embark on a cross-country adventure to find Harry's long-lost daughter in order to give him a kidney transplant.
It's a postcard from Freda Felcher. Harry, I'm pregnant. Please call me.
What do you think it means, Harry?
Lloyd, I'm going to be a dad.
Ah!
Look at the postmark. 1991.
I had a daughter. I gave her up for adoption.
What if we go track her down?
You're hot for my daughter.
What?
Am I right?
What?
Am I right?
That's insane. Whoever this is, we're in the middle of something very important here.
This is your dad.
What?
Hey, guys, I know this is weird timing, but I gotta take this. It's my dead dad.
You remember how I said earlier that the Sony Pictures Aunt May spy movie just reeks of desperation? This movie kind of reeks of desperation. It's not unfunny, and that's the thing. I mean, when I first heard that they were making this, I was like, holy cow, this is going to be terrible top to bottom, left to right, start to finish. And what's funny is that when they made the first sequel, prequel, like it was 2003, 2004, when they made Dumb and Dumberer, even though that was a terrible movie, I was just like, hey, it was okay. It had some funny moments. I wasn't expecting much because it was a totally different cast. Nobody involved from the first film, really. I think the Farrelly brothers were producing. But now here we are, 20 years removed from the first Dumb and Dumber. And the Farrelly brothers, first of all, the Farrelly brothers have kind of lost their edge. I think they were kind of like a 90s phenomenon. You know, they had this string of really fun movies like Dumb and Dumber, and I didn't like Kingpin, but I know a lot of people did, but they had like, There's Something About Mary, which is probably their biggest well-known piece. Even Me, Myself, and Irene. But they were very 90s, and there's something about the 90s that it was like, it was okay to make fun of everybody. And it was okay to poke fun at people, because that's what Dumb and Dumber, it was originally, it's two guys that are mentally challenged. It's clear that these people are not right in the head, which is different than, like, say, the Three Stooges. The Three Stooges are just buffoons. I'm not talking about the Farrelly Brothers Three Stooges, because that was bad. I'm talking about the original Three Stooges. They were not, for lack of a better, they were not mentally retarded people acting stupid. The Three Stooges were normal guys who were just buffoons in real life. They were obnoxious, they were vulgar, they were just kind of dullards. But you never thought that there was really something wrong with their mental capacity, necessarily. Dumb and Dumber, it was basically making fun of mentally challenged people. It's not considered cool now. And if you look at their string of films, like Me, Myself, and Irene was making fun of split personalities. Stuck on You was making fun of conjoined twins. Shallow Hal was making fun of fat people. I mean, they basically have to have somebody to poke fun of, at least with their string of movies from the 90s and into the 2000s to work. And I think that brand of humor, that type of overt making fun of humor, has kind of gone out of style, and that's a good thing. But they're bringing it back here, and I don't know, it's just kind of pathetic. There's some funny parts, and there's some jokes that are funny. You'll laugh at a couple things. There's some scenes that were entertaining, you know, from a completely basal standpoint. But as a controlled film, it's better than Dumb and Dumberer, because you've got professionals working on it. You've got Jeff Daniels and Jim Carrey back as the lead characters, as the title characters, quite literally. And Jeff Daniels actually is really pretty good in it. I mean, I give him a lot of credit. Actually, I thought he was what was funnier in the original movie, because Jim Carrey was the star at the time, and Jeff Daniels, I heard an interview with him where he said he had to audition for it. He realized, oh, no, I'm auditioning to be in this Jim Carrey movie. Jeff Daniels, who'd been around for decades. So while I think Jeff Daniels does a good job there, and Jim Carrey brings his same thing that he brought in the first movie, but it's just kind of tired now. It was different when it was like he was fresh, when he was new, and it was like this was this string of things after like Ace Ventura and The Mask, and suddenly he's on the scene. But you know, this reminded me of seeing, of like going to the bar with your buddies and you're like in your mid 40s and they're trying to hit on college girls with the moves and the lines they used 20 years ago. And you're like, ooh, yeah, you're balding and fat now. It doesn't work. It's no longer cool. And this is mean-spirited. This is a mean-spirited movie. It is making fun of retarded people. And the Farrelly brothers would be like, oh, no, some of our best friends are retarded people, because they've done that, and there's Something About Mary. They actually have a bunch of people they knew and friends of theirs that were, I forget how they're related to somehow. They either knew somebody or there's a family member, and they knew a lot of people who were mentally challenged. And in Something About Mary, there's a whole scene with the group of them from, you know, in a community or something like that. And they have one scene in there where they have a retarded guy who plays an orderly at an old folks home. And it's almost like they're like, it's the equivalent of somebody saying, well, I'm not racist because I have a black friend. No, I'm not racist. I voted for Obama or whatever. Somebody that kind of qualifier was like, oh, no, we're not making fun of retarded people. Look, we got a retarded guy in the movie. And I'm still kind of crass. I mean, that's still what they're making fun of these guys as. It's, I don't know. I think it's just out of its time. If this had been made in 1996, it probably would have been a huge hit and probably been a much better movie. But right now, it just reeks of desperation, and it's just kind of sad. So I'm going to have to say Dumb and Dumber 2 kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Wolves. A high school football player discovers he's a werewolf, goes on the run, and winds up in his family's hometown where he must battle the pack's alpha.
She's a monster.
I think you think I'm somebody else.
So you think you're somebody else. It's Connor, man. He decides who lives and who dies.
He'll butcher anyone that stands in his way.
Those guys out there are wolves all the time.
You think I'm afraid of dying?
It's not the dying, John. It's what comes first.
Okay then, boys. Let's show them what we really are.
I do not know why this movie didn't come out a month ago, because it's a horror movie and it's hard. That's really what it is. I mean, ultimately it's Teen Wolf. That's really what it is. I mean, they just don't play lacrosse. He plays football. I mean, the movie starts like the first 15 minutes is Teen Wolf. It's this kid. Is he a quarterback or a running back? I don't know, whatever. I don't know sports, but he's on the football team dating the cheerleader, and he starts getting kind of wolfy, and then he goes on the run. And I mean, I don't know, maybe they're trying to differentiate it from a horror movie, because at its heart, I think it's trying to be a horror movie, but also it's trying to be a modern werewolf movie, where the people making this might be, oh, no, it's not a horror movie. It's not a scary movie, because it's not scary. I mean, I don't know. I find that qualifier sort of dumb anyways. Because there are people, I've heard people say, well, that didn't scare me. That's not a horror movie. Well, it's a horror movie, has elements. There's very few movies that scare me. I see horror movies all the time, and I love them. This one isn't really a horror movie. I don't think it's out there to scare anybody. It's a little bit more of like an action movie than anything else. It falls in line much more, I don't know, like a Dolph Lundgren or Chuck Norris action movie from the 80s. You know, sort of like a guy rides into town and he has to fight the bad guys with the black hats on black horses. And I mean, it works for what it is. It's Teen Wolf. If you like Teen Wolf, you'll probably enjoy this one, because it has the sort of teen romance. I don't know. It wasn't terrible. It's on demand right now. So check it out if you can, if you like that sort of thing. Don't expect scary. Don't expect a horror movie necessarily. Expect Teen Wolf. If you watch Teen Wolf on MTV. Now, I'm not talking about the Teen Wolf with Michael J. Fox. I'm talking about the Teen Wolf TV show right now. Something like Vampire Diaries. You know, something like Supernatural. Supernatural is another. It's cut from that cloth. For that, I'm going to say Wolves kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
All right, with that, I need to go to a break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking about Beyond the Lights and Beside Still Waters.
I'm too sexy for my shirt. Too sexy for my shirt. So sexy, it hurts.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys of the Movies, continuing the show, continuing the movie reviews, some of the best movie reviews you're ever going to hear in the entire universe. No hyperbole at all whatsoever. The first one we're going to be talking about is Beyond the Lights. A pop star attempts suicide and soon falls in love with the cop on security detail who saved her life.
Noni is supposed to be the girl that every guy wants. We're selling fantasy here.
Everybody says I'm special because I have this voice, but I'm just saying what everybody else wants me to say.
No, wait! Hey, look at me!
I see you. I see you.
It's in the moments when you're left all on your own.
That night on the balcony, you were screaming, I see you. So, just what do you see?
This one stars, and I hope I pronounce her name right, because I'm always afraid I won't. It's Gugu Mbatha-Raw, who most recently she was in Belle, where she played the aristocrat of mixed blood. And she was dealing with the fact that, you know, she was technically the daughter of somebody of some sort of stature, but her mother was black, so she was half black, and so she kind of lived both worlds, and it's not a bad movie by Fox Searchlight. And I will always remember her as Martha Jones' sister in Doctor Who. She played her in a couple episodes of Doctor Who. Beautiful woman. I mean, she's really a gorgeous, gorgeous woman. This film is a very basic romance. I mean, it is not anything deep. It is not a heavy character study. It's not overly complex. It's pretty straightforward. It's about a woman who is sort of a puppet for her mother, who's her manager, and the record labels, and she sort of does what she's told, and she's built this image, and she's become famous, and she's winning like an American Music Award before she even drops her first album, but it's not what she wants to do, and nobody listens to her. Nobody wants her for her. They want her for the image. And it's this security guard, this off-duty cop, who catches her eye and actually treats her like a human being. It's played by Nate Palmer, he's okay in the movie. He's not, but what's fascinating about this movie is it works for what it is. I mean, it's a sweet little romance, and the acting for her, at least Gugu Mbatha-Raw, does a really fine job with it. All of the character developments on her, all of the change and the differences, that's all on her. Nate Palmer, pretty much, he has a story where his father, who's in the police force with him, is grooming him to become a politician. But really, they're just going through the motions for that. I mean, they're just putting it in there so that he just doesn't show up only as a supporting role. But pretty much, he's there to look pretty and have her fall in love with him. And when I'm watching it, I was like, wow, this is kind of interesting, because this movie is exactly the opposite of what you normally see in Hollywood. Normally, you see a movie where you've got the main star, the main character's a guy, and the guy has these things he's dealing with. The guy needs to go through change. Whenever you have a movie that has character development, you want to have some sort of change happen in the character. The character either has to find himself or stand up for something. All that happens with the woman in this, and he is very marginalized in the film, which makes this movie a bizarrely brilliant piece of feminist filmmaking. And I say that with no irony or joke to it at all. I honestly believe that this film is more progressive, if you want to use that word, than most movies that you would actually see. It's directed by Gina Prince Blythewood, who was most well known for writing and directing Love and Basketball. So it is directed by a woman, as opposed to a man. So that might be part of the reason why it leans very much on the female side, but I just found it fascinating to watch, because it's almost unashamedly twisting the roles around and flipping them around. And I don't know if they meant to do that, or they just wrote that way, or they said, hey, let's take a story about a guy who falls in love, but then just make it a woman. And that's what they did. And it really kind of works, and it kind of puts the men in their place. If you're watching the movie as a man, you're kind of like, oh, we're just there to be pretty and fall in love with. That's what I do. That's how I landed my wife. I was just pretty so she could fall in love with me. That's how it works, man. So there's this thing out there called the Bechdel test, which is based on a woman who her last name is Bechdel. And she came up with this and saying, this is how you can tell whether a movie is good for women. If there's more than one female character, and if the female characters talk to each other at least once, but the conversation can't be about a guy. It has to be about something else. And a lot of movies famously fail this stuff. I mean, some of the greatest movies ever. Jaws fails this test spectacularly. The Thing, one of my favorite movies of all time, doesn't even have women in it, so it just fails it off the bat. But what's interesting about this movie, it's the antithesis of the Bechdel test. It passes the Bechdel test with flying colors. I mean, then again, most lesbian porn also passes the Bechdel test with flying colors because there's no men in it. And they don't talk about guys. But you know, the problems with the test aside, but if you go the other way around, it just barely passes the antithesis of it. You might have one or two scenes where two guys are talking to each other and it's not about a woman. So it's a fascinating look at the feminist filmmaking. And I think this is much more, if you want to use the term feminist filmmaking, if you don't cringe at that or get scared off by that, this movie's a great example of it because it just tells a story. And it's not only when you reflect on it that you realize that that's what it does. But even then, it's effectively done. It's well made. It's well acted. But overall, I'm going to say Beyond the Lights kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's move on to Beside Still Waters. This one is the directorial debut of Chris Lowell, who most people will recognize either from Private Practice, which is one of the Shonda Rhimes series. More famously, he played Piz on Veronica Mars, and of course in the Veronica Mars movie that came out earlier this year. This is his directorial debut. After the death of his parents, a man returns to his family's cabin for one last weekend with his high school friends.
Where are you guys?
Checking out the spot where Daniel's parents died.
Oh. Whenever you're ready to talk, we're here for you, buddy.
I don't need to talk.
Buddy! Wild night last night, right?
I told you I don't want to talk about last night.
Maybe you feel like talking about last night.
I had the worst night of my life.
I had the best night of my life.
You want to keep this secret?
Yes.
No.
Yes.
I need coffee.
Now, when this movie came across my desk, I was a little bit gun-shy with it. And here's why. Because ever since when I did independent filmmaking, everybody has a script. If you tell people that you're making independent film, everyone's like, oh, I got a script. Can you read it for me? And they either want feedback. They don't want feedback. They want you to tell them it's great. But everybody would give me scripts or tell me these things, or they'd show me a movie, and it's everybody has a movie about a group of friends that are in their 20s that have gone back together and had that one last time, and then there's that one girl, that the girl that got away, and that's kind of what this movie is. It's about this group of friends that get together, and it's always a difference. There's always a different reason why they're getting together, but that's what this movie started out as, and I was a little bit nervous because I was going to be like, I don't want to hate it. But you know what? For as many of those movies as I've seen, this one does it very well, and it does some things that I never expected, which that's a huge kudos to Lowell for putting that in there, because I've seen so many of these movies, and I've read countless screenplays, independent screenplays, unproduced screenplays of people making these movies that are kind of the same thing. But he does some different things. The characters go to different places. The characters interact differently. The resolution of one of the characters, which is so trite usually, he does something kind of brilliant with it. I don't want to say, and it's a spoiler if I were to tell you what it is, but how he resolves something is actually kind of brilliant. It's surprising. It takes a lot to surprise me in a film because I've seen so many of them, and it's my job to kind of break them down. But I saw this movie and I was like, wow, that's different. And there's one scene, and you hear it in the trailer where they're going back and forth about The Greatest Night or whatever, and there's some really good comedic timing in here. It works for a movie. Good job to Chris Lowell, because he took a template that has been done a million times before, and he made it his own. And that's really what filmmaking is. There are no original stories. Every now and then you swerve up against one, like Being John Malkovich or something. But there are no original stories. Every love story is a love story. Every action movie is an action movie. And this is a second coming of age movies. We talked about second coming of age movies last week with Laggies. So this one's kind of a second coming of age movie because it's him trying to put aside his past and the person trying to move on. It's well acted. It moves. It doesn't drag. It's pretty short, but that serves it well. It tells its story and it gets out of there. This is a small film. It's picked up by Tribeca. If you can catch it in the theater, great. If you can get it on demand, that's awesome. Check it out, especially if you like these sort of independent character studies. Don't be turned away by it being somewhat of a familiar story, because like I said, it kind of knocks that out of the park. I'm going to say that Beside Still Waters kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
All right, I need to go to a break. When I come back, we're going to be talking about the box office and the world-famous DVD Roundup. It's Kevin Carr with Fat Guys of the Movies, continuing my awesome coverage of the film in the cinemas. Speaking of cinemas, let's talk about cinematic filmmaking and cinematic responses. Not just any just stupid movie that just vomits through a projector. Let's talk about Interstellar and the fallout from Interstellar. I find it fascinating the bipolar nature of the internet. I live on the internet. I don't really read magazines anymore, especially not for film. Magazines take way too long to get the information out there. By the time I used to get subscriptions to The Hollywood Reporter, and I'd read stuff a month later than what I saw it online. I mean, that's just the nature of the publishing business. Where the actual happening is going on is with film is on the internet. And it was fascinating to watch the insane reaction of everybody with Interstellar, because it started off as everyone was just couldn't wait to Interstellar. I'm going to go buy tickets to see it in 70 millimeter, and everyone got to see it early in 70 millimeter. And everyone came out and they're like, well, it's not perfect, but it's so awesome because it's Christopher Nolan and it's 70 millimeter and it's film. Don't you know? It's film. It's 70 millimeter. And then the wider reviews came out and people are like, nah, it's good, but it's got some problems. And then it suddenly swerves into this thing where everyone's like, oh, well, here's a problem with it. I'm going to write this article about how this movie got the science wrong, or got this wrong, or got that wrong, or this was stupid, or, you know, it's the equivalent. And people bash on this. I mean, I love honest trailers. I think they're great. But everyone can't do it. It's like Mystery Science Theater is great, but that doesn't mean everybody should be doing it. And we're in a world where honest trailers, where everyone's trying to pick apart honest. I wrote an article about Interstellar, about whether or not it's possible to actually, or even a good idea, to go to a planet on the edge of a black hole like they do in this movie. So then you had this, everyone picking it apart. And then suddenly you had this backlash against people having a backlash against the movie. So you had people complaining, oh, well, it's no movie's perfect and you need to just enjoy it for the experience and shame on you. And I actually read somewhere where somebody was like, well, is it possible that Christopher Nolan's the greatest director ever? No, he's not. Christopher Nolan is a good director, but he's not flawless. And his last two movies have been his best film of all. Probably, well, I mean, Dark Knight's really good, but Memento. I mean, he hasn't topped his first film. I mean, in terms of craft. He's made him bigger and louder and he made it more of an experience, but I don't think he's ever topped Memento in terms of crafting a film. But what's interesting is even Christopher Nolan came out and responded to this, saying, oh yeah, there's plot holes, but it's on sound scientific theory. I'm not questioning the scientific theory. I mean, you have superhero films, you have Iron Man, you have the Avengers, which has really no basis in science. It's all nonsense. It just is. It's superheroes. It's cartoony. And that's okay. That's the suspension of disbelief. Star Wars is complete nonsense. You don't have light speed and you can't do dogfights that you can't sneak up on a planet. You know, it's because it's space. It's huge. So it's fine for something to be sort of nonsensical and to take a lot of liberties because it's movies. You got to make movies. And so this is based on science. And while it's cool, my problems with it have nothing to do with the science being wrong. My problems have to do with the fact that the characters did stupid things. That the characters who should have known better should have done. It has way too much Matthew McConaughey cry face in it. It has way too much emotion. And Christopher Nolan's a cold director. And the movie's just too freaking long. So, I mean, there's a lot of problems with this movie that have nothing to do with the scientific theory. That's great. Christopher Nolan, congratulations. And Neil deGrasse Tyson even came out and saw the movie. He's like, oh, this is great to see them presenting a black hole the way black holes actually, as we understand them, exist. You know, unlike a movie like The Black Hole, which makes it look like a ring around the toilet kind of drain. But then Neil deGrasse Tyson went on in an interview to say that Contact was his favorite science-y science fiction movie, and that movie's just freaking terrible. I mean, it's accurate scientifically. And Carl Sagan, deGrasse Tyson's hero, he wrote that, and it all is based on science, but the movie's terrible. My problem with this whole thing is I am so sick and tired of the Nolan can do no wrong, because he can. He doesn't, it's intellectually dishonest to go out there and say he makes these smart, brilliant movies. They're not. He doesn't make deep movies. He doesn't make intelligent movies. He's like M. Night Shyamalan. He makes Twilight Zone episodes. They have high concept pulp ideas that Hollywood's normally scared of, but they're not smart necessarily. Interstellar's no more smart. I mean, yeah, it's technically smart, but it's no more smart than The Village or The Sixth Sense. I know it's going to offend a lot of people, but that's true. It's like when Lucy came out earlier this summer, or Edge of Tomorrow earlier this year. Those are two very fun sci-fi pulpy genre films. They're not terribly smart. they're Pulp Fiction. It's just Hollywood's normally, and it's traditionally, scared of these kind of movies because up until recently, they really didn't make a whole lot of money. Science fiction, I remember back in the 90s and the 80s, you go to a Blockbuster Video, they had a science fiction section. It was very, very small. A lot of movies didn't want to call themselves science fiction because the burst of science fiction after Star Wars, people realize, well, it's not the science fiction that's that people are gravitating towards. It's the action and the grand space opera. It's the same reasoning why way back in 1939, when they're going to release Wizard of Oz, they made that it was all a dream ending. And they made that it was all a dream ending because honestly, the studio came in and said, the people are not going to get it. The people are going to be confused by Oz actually existing. And so they made this, it was all a dream ending. It was because they thought the audience was too stupid to get it. I think the audience is smart enough. I mean, don't pat yourself on the back if you understood Inception. It's not hard to understand. Dream within a dream within a dream. Boom. There you go. People who read Pulp Fiction and watch Pulp Fiction kind of movies and watch genre fiction, it comes naturally to them because they see it all the time. But if all you do is watch dramas and award films, and then you see a movie like Inception or Interstellar, you're going to be like, whoa, this is groundbreaking and different, when it's really not. It's a lot of the same concepts we've seen on Star Trek and Stargate for decades. I guess that all goes back to the fact that Nolan's not the greatest director ever, and I think he needs to do something a little more intimate. He needs to get away from just the grandeur because he's tilting at windmills here. All right, you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office really quick. Speaking of Interstellar, was I correct? I had said $62 million for Big Hero 6 to win the weekend. It didn't make that much, but I can claim victory over everybody because I'm the only person I know who actually dared suggest that Big Hero 6 was going to beat Interstellar. And I wasn't just kind of right. I was totally right. It beat it by almost $10 million, $56 million to $47 million. $9 million spread. That's pretty significant. I mean, it's a definitive win for Big Hero 6. I went a little high on my estimation, but Interstellar didn't even make $50 million. That makes sense. It's a three-hour movie with, you know, with some plotting problems. And you know what? Somebody reached out to me on my website and framed it as this. Is it worth $100 to see this movie? Because he's married and he's got kids. And he said, if I go see a movie, I got to pay for the tickets. I got to pay for parking. I got to pay for a babysitter. We usually get snacks or dinner. And it ends up costing about $100 to go to a movie. Is it Interstellar worth paying $100 to see? No, it's not. For that matter, not a whole lot of movies are. You know, if I were going to be blowing $100 every time I was going to go to the movie theater, I would probably see about 10 movies in the theater every year. That's a good way to look at it. Is it worth $100? Well, Big Hero 6 was worth $56 million. Interstellar was worth $47.5 million. And then it goes down the list. Huge drop to then Gone Girl. This week, I'm going to say Big Hero 6 wins again. It's going to split down a little bit more, you know, maybe 60%, $33 million. I don't think Dumb and Dumber 2 is going to overcome it. I think it's going to have a front-loaded weekend. I think there's a lot of people, the sort of the high school, college crowd, are going to go see it. I've seen it Thursday night and Friday, and by the time Saturday afternoon's rolled around and then Sunday, it's the band will have burned off. And Big Hero 6 will continue to play strongly through the weekend because there's nothing really competing against it this week. All right, that sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD roundup. Probably my favorite thing for this spread is Batman, the complete series. Way back when, 20th Century Fox made the Batman series in the mid-1960s. For years, even though it played on TV, you could find it on TV all the time, but it never got released on home video. The best you ever got was the Batman movie when they made the movie version of that show. And the reasoning was a rights issue because at the time, 20th Century Fox did the series and Warner Brothers owned DC Comics, which owns Batman. And it suddenly got tangled up in rights. And then you've got DVD rights because suddenly when things start going to DVD, it's different than the syndication rights on television. And it just was mired in legal battles and kind of a mess. Now they finally released a complete series on Blu-ray. This is the kind of thing that I want for Christmas. Anyone who wants to send it to me, you're more than welcome to. Go to fatguysatthemovies.com. You'll find an address somewhere. A couple other ones. Jersey Boys is out. That was okay. Clint Eastwood doing a musical. How to Train Your Dragon 2. Not a bad movie. I actually liked it better than the first, but I wasn't a huge fan of the first one. So I know people thought it was a little bit of a letdown, but I did enjoy it to a degree. Let's Be Cops, which is very funny. Jake Johnson and Damon Wayans Jr. as fake cops. True Blood Season 7, and then a couple Star Wars things. You got Phineas and Ferb Star Wars, their Star Wars episode, which is available on DVD, and the Clone Wars The Lost episode's also available on DVD. The Stinger of the Week is Tammy, Melissa McCarthy's terrible, terrible, terrible movie about dumb. Not dumb and dumber, just dumb. Just dumb. It's there. All right, next week we're going to be talking about The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 1, The Theory of Everything, and Rosewater. I gotta go. I'll talk to you next week. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.